Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 30th of August, 2020. And as always, I hope you're hanging in there and getting through these insane times, because we're living through the biggest exercise, really, in mind control and warfare. It's all warfare. It's mental warfare in the whole population of the planet, and psyops, etc., and revolutions, all sponsored often and traced back to the same few people. It's quite astonishing, isn't it, that regardless of the COVID idea and the Bill Gates Foundation, the Melinda Gates Foundation, and Fauci and all these characters, and the head of the WHO, you can tie them all together, can't you? And you see all the funding from the same old big corporations going to BLM, which again is Marxist, as we know. A beautiful cover, though. Remember, communism always hides behind covers. It uses excuses. It always did. There were dozens and dozens of them in the 1960s that were Christian. And the Christian groups and churches had no idea they were getting used. But they were great covers, because they would promote policies which the Marxists wanted to be put into, to weaken America, actually. And that's what you always find. Behind the covers, there's a weakening of the state. And, yeah, you can always complain about the state as much as you want. The state of affairs isn't that great, is it? But the reality, too, is that there are other players that simply want to end up in the ruling seats and displace the present rulers of it all. That's really what it is. Or really, to maximize their power, their existing power, and take over their remaining seats in politics and governance and so on. And you have to understand that you're living through amazing times, that nothing's happening by chance. You've got the Pentagon, obviously, in on the same act, with different generals standing by. They're all on the payroll of the military-industrial complex, which will still be working for a long time under the auspices of the United Nations and NATO organization, as they, again, go through this game of divvying up the world into competing factions of apparent conflict, you know. That's how the Cold War was, really. There were more billionaires created during the Cold War than ever before, maybe even afterwards, because all governments and all sides took tax money and put billions and billions, without question, into defending the people by creating more and more missiles, etc., and jets and military equipment. Way overpriced anyway, doesn't matter what they made, it was always way overpriced. But no questions were asked. Like the COVID idea, it's to keep you safe. So it's, you know, it's a wartime scenario, you see. And of course, COVID has all the attributes of a wartime scenario. Of course it does. More than you think, actually. Because there are signs and symptoms to techniques of controlling the public through fear and wartime for compliance reasons. And we've had all the exercises exposed from Event 201 and long before that, too, with the Rockefeller lockstep idea as well. And again, many other organizations some of them I'll mention tonight, that the Gavi and Bill Gates group still control as well. There are so many organizations, you see, all telling you the same stories. So important to control all the media and the flow of information. You think you've got lots of competing organizations giving... they're giving the same opinions, all the media, the official media, because they're all owned by a small coterie of people. Going way back, I mentioned that years ago in talks, when Rockefeller and others, but Rockefeller especially, got a group of his hijackers, you know, to get, because they hijacked other companies all the time to basically take them over and stop competition. Old man Rockefeller said that competition is a sin. And he meant it. There's an organization running the world that truly believes they have the right to own everything in it, the technocratic type, and to rule everybody under it, basically. That hasn't changed. It's more than ever enforced today. You can actually see some of the front people coming forward, maybe lower edges of them, but it's still the same organization. And the idea was to take over the world's resources. Everything that you need to exist as an individual human being, and then collectively, is owned by people you don't even know, generally. They make all the policies, how much food you're going to be able to buy, or even get, or even if you can get it, or even if you can buy it. And it's all coming to pass right now, because this is to be your winter of discontent is coming up. Because it'll either make or break this big agenda for the World Economic Forum, for its global reset, you know, of the economy, of your way of living, on the value, actual value, and the, basically the, almost like an examination paper with tick marks. You'll all get checked off on a checklist of things that, they'll give you extra help if you need it, if you're ill or whatever it happens to be, according to your status or importance or necessity to their society. That's how it's going to get put out, actually. It's already in force. And that's why they're killing a lot of elderly people in the hospitals. It was in force before COVID came along, when they introduced euthanasia. Everything's economics, you see, and the value to their system. Even though you paid for it, it doesn't make any difference. They're thieves that run the world. And they have all the signs and symptoms of gangs. And that's a fact. There are other people who have come out with this too, that you have all the signs and symptoms of organized crime, big, big organized crime at the very top. And the relationship, as I've mentioned before, between Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation and the guest, don't forget too, Fauci and his wife. And his wife too is a bioethicist working with the government to again evaluate the everybody's status in society and your value to the system. And that's what bioethics is all about, folks. That's what it's about. So you're living through the big scientific takeover of society for the planet. They've always been after this global society, and going way back into the 1800s, folk have no idea that the British Empire, this oddball thing, the British Empire, was run by a secretive group in the city of London, Lord Alfred Milner. He published books himself about it. And he, and again, some of the people who took over much later, like Carl Quigley, who was a historian for them, praised them to the highest heavens for taking over the world and trying to get a world governmental system in place. Again, with this, he didn't mention technocratic system, but that's what it was. Quigley knew it was, because he believed that the right, again, to go after the world's resources even then, and he was all for their agenda. And Britain was used. Really, the people who get used, generations can pass, they haven't got a clue they're being used. You understand that? They just think, well, we're off to another war with so-and-so today, and it might last for a few years. And after it's over, you don't realize, no, maybe two dozen people have corporations in London that end up ransacking that country by taking resources out of it, and your troops are guarding it all for them. Even the troops don't really know what they're there for, except they're bringing civilization, they think, to these people. It's quite amazing to watch it happen, because it's still happening today. Huh? Often the countries that were dominated are coming back to the parent countries, like Britain, and dictating to them now, because often, in some ways, they become wealthier themselves, the people that were left behind, and now they're dictating their policies too for a global system again, because everyone from every nation at the top is part of this big structure. They know what's going on. Of course they know what's going on. And Quigley was awfully good about telling you that the top people in every party pretty well across the whole Western world, doesn't matter what the party was, top people are always a member of the same organization. They're vetted way in advance, and they play the game of left and right, etc. And then when you have their books, their members' books, which they published at one time when they had annual meetings, you see all the names at the back. Even the heads of communist parties for countries like in Britain were in attendance to their global meetings. And Ireland too, right? A lot of their members were there too. So, and the top bankers that ran these nations were also in attendance, say, for the future of the British Empire, funded by Rockefeller And of course, all the old Milner Group's guys were there that had taken over, and their descendants, because they hand them off to their offspring. And here we are down to the present day. Folks still can't, because it's never mentioned, so you can't catch on, you see. It's not mentioned very much at all. In fact, the history given by the BBC is such a, well, Orwell said it, eh? He controls the past, etc., and the future and all the rest of it. It's all been said before. And it's so true. It's so incredibly true. And then again, you have this wonderful, and it's wonderful from the elite's point of view, way of running the world through creating factions and divisions. Eh? And Britain's sunk, basically, with mass migration, so is Germany, to an extent, too, all from these wars in the Middle East and across Northern Africa for years and years. And they haven't finished yet. We know that there'll be even more, so that'll be the complete end of it, when more, again, military-age guys will rush through by the millions into Europe, when they do away with the last few countries left, like Syria. They won't give up with Syria and Iran, because it's not our wars. It's for another reason, as we all know. And, by the way, that is another reason as well, that a lot of folk are protesting and really upset and ticked off, because these endless wars... that people haven't fathomed, they can't fathom out why they're even going on. I mean, the wealth of America, of I'm talking about the average citizen, has been squandered in 30 years of straight years of war. People forget that. It didn't start with 9/11. They already had Desert Storm about 1991, and then had the flyovers and all the military around Iraq for years. That's a fortune right there. And then they hit it again in 2003, using it as an excuse. Of course, 9/11 is an excuse, even though Saddam had nothing to do with it. It was all on the list of the PNAC group. We all know that stuff. It's all published. You can find it up there, yeah, I'm sure, on the net. So you're living through a big agenda. I mentioned it so many times. You're living through a script. It's a big business plan, exactly as how a big business plan runs. And business plans, and that's a striking thing with United Nations and the communist organizations before the United Nations, they all have these five-year plans for one part and 10 years for another and 50-year plans for some, and even 100-year plans for other parts of it. That's how it's run. And that's how big multinational, international corporations run too. Huge agendas going way off into the future, where maybe they'll hire and retire three generations sometimes, you know, all planned that way. How do we make it happen? And then have their foundations, which are so important to all of this, the tax-free foundations that manage the world. You know, these are the ones who create and finance and train leaders for future warfare, including the NGOs. And the ones who train the Antifa groups, etc. They're all from the big foundations owned by the richest folk on the planet. This is not conspiracy stuff. Read foundations, their power and influence, written years ago, all to do with Norman Dodd's investigation into it and the Rees Committee. How they looked into the foundations in America back in the 50s and 60s. And I wondered why they were funding the top foundation, like the Ford Carnegie and the Ford Foundation, but that time was already taken over by other foundations that are awfully well known. And that they were funding groups to destroy America and radically change it, and so it made no sense to the people. So they sent a congressional committee out there to investigate it, and they were shocked by what they found. The head of the Ford Foundation at that time admitted, and you actually get old audios or videos of Norman Dodd talking about this, you know? And he asked them why they were funding these groups, and the head of the Ford Foundation in America said that we're working hard to create a system, an alteration of cultures and education, so we can seamlessly blend that of the Soviet Union with America. Down the road, they could blend it all together. Yeah. Most folk haven't got a clue today about all that. It's just amazing, but it's all published. It's in their books, written by the guys who were involved in it. And that's what I'm often said too. You can stuff your head full of all the data you want, but it's not enough, obviously, to change the present, which is the way you change the future. You've got to understand more. It's more than just learning who did what. You've got to find out why. You also have to look into all the whys, how people went along with things, and why they went along with things and accepted conditions and systems that they shouldn't have. Again, too, how can you possibly even live under a system and accept at the same time that most of the agencies above you and government are secret and run secretively on plans and agendas you're not given even access to? You might down the road have laws implemented by them upon you, but you know you're not even brought into the debate about things, to setting up right now. Who decides the future of a nation? Think about it. Do you get to fill out questionnaires about what you want to see in the future of a nation? Do you? For voting? You're just given the front people to vote for, aren't you? It doesn't matter what party is in, the same agenda goes ahead. Look at the free trade deals. Generations went by for free trade deals pretty well. And then the ones in the 90s to do with the North American free trade. First it was a free trade agreement, the North American free trade agreement. And then you had the three amigos, two prime ministers and a president, Mexico, Canada, the States, meeting every year to further tie us into a binding, that's what they called it, a binding system, bound together, which would be the nucleus of an EU-type authority, a European parliamentary authority down the road. That's what they hoped for. And then they would start bringing more Latin American countries in, and the Caribbean countries too, naturally. All discussed and printed and the rest of it. But it was done, it was admitted to, that the whole thing was drafted up and worked upon for years by the Council on Foreign Relations, a group that's private, a private group that often claims itself to be the establishment. One of his videos it put out itself talked about this, itself as the establishment. And you don't vote for them. Most folk don't even know what they are or that they exist. You're given these front comedians or politicians to look at and boo and throw tomatoes at, you know. And that's what you're given for politics. Have you ever heard any real wisdom come out of the mouths of politicians? Come on. Come on. You watch this Punch and Judy show. That's what it's called, Punch and Judy show. Like they used to have at fairs in the Middle Ages and all up to the 20th century, where people would have these puppets bashing each other with clubs and so on. That's what politicians are. They're there to take the heat, but not to ever tell you what's really going on. The key to all of this, of course, is that think tanks, privately owned think tanks, have run the world for an awful long time. And they still do. The top politicians are picked long before the public even hear their names to vote for. And they're vetted, and they'll do what they're told, there's no doubt about it. And all parties are in on it at the top. That's why when nothing really changes for the better for the general population, it gets worse and worse. And I can remember looking at the old books I found about Canada as an example, and I've seen the same for Britain. But you have the Departments of Information and Statistics, and owned by the government pretty well, and everyone's measured and weighed and yada yada and numbered long, long before we came along, our generation. And I've got ones going back to the early 1900s and right down to how many matchsticks were made by companies and things like that. Just incredible data they had in us all before they had computers. At least we're told it anyway. But anyway, it is quite fascinating to see how these massive books with the year's production and costs and all the rest of it, and every little company in the country listed. But back in the early 20th century in Canada, Britain at that time, or London, they ran it all. I hate saying Britain, it's like a strange entity. What the heck is Britain really? It's got millions of people, all kinds of people living in it. And before the mass migration, there were still lots of different kinds living in it. The Yorkshire folk had their own identity and same culture. It was, and in different parts of the country was similar. Had been for centuries, that kind of thing. But when it comes to official purposes, you see, in taxation and things like that, then they want you to be one part of Britain, or for war, and send you off to fight for things you have no idea that it's really all about. You never get told the truth. And when you come back from these wars, the ordinary folk have either lost their jobs or work or their farms or whatever, and nothing's ever the same again. And then you got another one. It's the same kind of thing over and over. And between that, you're global. I remember back in the 90s talking about this. I said, eventually, you know, well, because you kept talking about globalist and global that, and how it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And we'd all be happy under globalism, and all the companies were putting this rah-rah thing, the governments were putting rah-rah and hands across the sea, etc. And they came out with their real plans, which was international free trade for the big top corporations. So they could really send their stuff all over the planet from all countries and have the citizens back home in the first world countries paying for all. Do you ever wonder why you can order things from China for peanuts, for cheaper than you could even post a letter in your own country to your neighbour? You're paying for it, that's why. That's called free trade. It's part of the deal. And it isn't just China you're paying for their postage or to you. It's quite a few countries too. We can look up the lists of the nations, including some in the Middle East, by the way. You're paying the bulk of their postage on whatever's getting transferred around the world. Free trade. Great deal for the corporations, isn't it? And you pay for all. And at the same time, you end up with no work back home. Because your own governments, again, all kinds, right-wing and left-wing in succession, all signed on to integrate it further and further as they get in. And then end up with no work back home, no factories, no ability to produce anything. You don't even have the ability to make your own basic painkillers or acetaminophen, the very simple medication. Because even that's farmed out to other countries. First it was farmed out to China under free trade. That's why it was so cheap for a long time. And then last year, the year before, they gave the contract under the new Trans-Pacific Partnership, which they included Indian for some reason. And then it moved their base of operations to India. And it's way more expensive now. But at home, nothing's made here. There you go. And you can't even make anything to save yourself if you need. This is the thing. I keep thinking back to Britain in World War One and then Two. And Britain was locked down in World War One because of Germany then, and Britain as well, had submarines. And submarines could play havoc with shipping that was bringing in food and supplies and all. But especially in World War Two, there's far more subs around. And Britain had already given up its ability to be self-sustaining by farming. I've always thought that's an odd thing. That, I mean, food is one of the most basic things you need. Without it, everything else is a pipe dream. Everything starts with food, folks. Food and water. And why would your nations literally make you helpless? Well, once again, it was the big corporations that dealt with the shipping lines. We've had leaders in Canada whose parents were involved in this too, that their own shipping line companies for transferring food to other countries, etc. And often when they're combined with interest in agriculture, like agri-food businesses, they decide what countries are going to get the cheap food and who's not going to eat, and even lobby at home to put laws to stop you even making enough food at home for yourself. This is all rigged, you see. There's no such thing as a free enterprise system. It's just the opposite. And it's not new. Say, Britain almost sunk in World War II because it couldn't produce the food for itself. It was almost completely dependent for a long time on food coming in from the US. And that ship eventually was in trouble after 1942 as well. And they had all, you can actually look up the old videos on wartime farms, for instance. And you see what they had to do, go through, and the government just expands. Oh, they love it during war. They expand socialistic systems and principles, and government departments just blossom and swell like cancers, like you wouldn't believe. And that's why they love socialism. Because anything you do, you're told, because it's all for the good of all. You're all in it together, etc. And you all pull along together and do what you're told for the good of everybody else, for the greater good. Never changes, eh? And during World War II, the government in Britain stole farms all over the place off of people. Because here's the tragedy of things. Great Britain, eh? Let's be proud of Great Britain, eh? There had been so many wars all through the 1800s. The country, the people were broke with taxes, and really, even then, they're kept in a starvation level. Most of the people, not the middle class and upper class, of course, but they were. They went through the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s. And 1800s. So bad it was that even Benjamin Franklin, this is the truth here, in his own memoirs, talked about that when he visited Britain, and he saw these factory workers coming out of a big shoe factory and boot factory barefoot in the winter because they couldn't afford to buy the boots themselves. This was reality, folks, you know. There was no welfare system. Folk had to work often 16 hours a day just to eat and get a place over their head, which was a hovel. Often there were 10, 12 or more to a room. It's a horror show. But again, the wonders of propaganda and so on can displace all that and really tuck it away into the background until it's a hazy thing, then it's forgotten altogether. That's how it works. And then you end up in the 20th century and they already just had the Boer War, you know, getting waylaid. They were taking over Africa and South Africa and so on. Again, by the Milner Group, Lord Alfred Milner, for the Royal Institute for International Affairs, that private group that was just called the Milner Group in the kindergarten at the time. And they picked youngsters up in university in Oxford, All Souls, and they trained them. They trained them to be governors of different countries that they would take over. And they list all their names, of course, if you go into their histories, long, long histories. But anyway, that's how it was done. And the people end up in these wars, world wars. They needed, by the way, the Milner Group wanted world wars. They mentioned that. Because then they could then further amalgamate countries, even competing and conflicting in warring countries together at the end of it, when everybody's on their knees. That's how you got the League of Nations idea coming in, you see. So it's, the past is a horror show. So anyway, World War II comes along, and Britain had lost so many farmers. And, like, you talk about dads and sons often, and uncles, all wiped out in some areas. A lot of them. They would join local regiments, boom, gone, same in Canada and elsewhere in Australia. Gone, New Zealand. And so it left a lot of them just struggling with farms in the 20 years between, you know, from the end of World War One and the beginnings of World War Two in 1939. And so the government, if you couldn't, they ordered you to produce, and if you couldn't produce enough because you didn't have enough manpower or people running the farm or whatever, or maybe it was an old dad left, all the sons were dead from the previous war, the government just grabbed them and stole them. And then they amalgamated a whole bunch of them, you see, here, there and everywhere, and they would give it to these rich characters who still own them today, by the way, you know. And then of course, they got volunteers and land army. It's even better, isn't it? It smacks the same kind of... you get little smackings or smatterings of the same system down to the present time. Because then you had land army volunteers and all these folk coming in for the war effort who were free labour for you. Hmm? And every square inch of workable land had to be ploughed, the whole thing, and used for the war effort. We're all in it together once more, you see. And you could get vegetables, but you couldn't get much meat at all for the general population. Winston Churchill hadn't a problem. They had parties for Winston. He'd talk about it. His secretary talked about it. If you ever bother reading the books on it, his personal secretary wrote about it. and how they had these huge parties in certain parts of London, underground bunkers, huge, like palaces, really. In fact, some of them were under palaces, and other ones were outside London, and they did everything they could imagine of eating and food and liquor and wines, etc., champagne, the whole lot, all through the war. But they're ordinary people. Like being good people, mind you, put up with it, and the rationing, starvation level rationing, until you, there was no obese people before World War II, pretty well, in Britain, because they'd been through a Great Depression in between two World Wars, and in both wars had rationing. It's just astonishing what you put up with. And the folk who go off and fight have no idea. They wouldn't even know who Lord Alfred Milner was. You might get his name in the newspaper once in a while as one of his proteges was sent over to govern South Africa or something like that, you know, or India. But they had no idea of this big, this, even Winston Churchill had an argument, is recorded in Parliament in Britain, because during the beginnings of the war, he had no idea that these characters have been manipulating the system to get Britain. He was also getting manipulated by another group to get into the war, by the way, an outside group. But the same token, he was ticked off when he found out that this other group that had other plans for the Great War, this World War II, you know, and his mission and what they'd wanted to accomplish, and he argued about it. Because at that time, it was a very secretive group, you know. Different names it had at the time. The All Souls group was one of them as well. It was so secretive, like layers of it, that in an inner party and an outer party, you know? Just like the CFR still has today for their missions abroad, so to speak. Yeah, the folk in Britain fought these wars, all truly believing they're doing the best of all to save everybody and doing it, you know, having a clue what was to come at the end of it, having a clue that Winston Churchill, and I put up the articles years ago, should you go into cuttingthroughthematrix.com and look at some of them. Lots of the authors use my material, sort of stacks over there. But Winston Churchill literally talks about all of this too, as I say. And his desire, he said, this is wonderful, when the war broke, he says, we shall probably, and hopefully, he says, establish our long dream of united Europe. I mean, meanwhile, he's telling folk on the radio at nights, you go off and fight and die to save your culture, your way of life. Meanwhile, he's talking, and his sector recorded all these things, eh? Our united Europe. Oh, no, died. Now, if you'd told that to the British folk at that time, they'd been completely bewildered. What was he talking about, united Europe? We're fighting to keep our own way of life. We're quite happy with it the way it is, you know. It's never perfect, and it's pretty bad for a lot of people, but it's better than a lot of folk had even in Europe at that time. And every culture likes its own culture to an extent, don't you? Because it's familiar to you, if nothing else. But it's also part of it, and I mean this, across the world you meet people who will fight and die for their nations, or the plot of land that they live on. It's a natural thing, you feel tied to the land, it's in the soil, it's in the genes almost, and you have that bonding to it. I remember reading a poem by a Scots guy that wrote about the 1930s and 40s, maybe into the 50s. A miner, and he talked about having to leave, because Scotland, like parts of England too, and Wales, because of this corrupt system that always ran you, was often, it couldn't afford to, as he said in his poem, a country like Scotland, it couldn't afford to feed his children, you know? So he had to move. But meanwhile, you had the richest folk concentrated in London. The richest folk in the world at that time concentrated in parts of London, especially the city of London. And of course, the migration helped, you see, to expand the empire. So we're all used and abused, and most folk haven't got a clue it's even happening at the time. Instead, they're given what they've got in the States at the moment. They've got the front groups the BLM groups, were the heads of them. It's no mystery. It's no conspiracy theory. They admit, and they're out there admitting, there's even a video of them admitting that they're trained Marxist organizers who know exactly what they're doing. Well, Marxism always has front groups and gets them all battling with other groups. And then you have the Antifa groups. There's no mystery there. There's a good, quite a good history of them, long history. And then the reorganization of them back again in the 90s, because they used them. They used to send them in to the anti-global meetings that were going on. The anti-globalist meetings were awfully good at the time, and folk came across from the countries to protest these meetings, where they were again planning offshore all your work and your factories off to China and the Far East. But in would come the Antifa group and jump in on the bandwagon and start throwing their usual Molotov cocktails at police cars, etc., and give everybody else a bad name, you see. And actually say it in their handbooks, you see, that they piggyback upon certain events that cause that are plausible that and are emotional events. Jump on top of them, end up being the champions, but then sear it off into your revolution. This is how they do it, you see. Well-funded, too. But once folks' emotions get up, they seldom think very clearly. It's very interesting to watch the phenomenon. I've mentioned it before, that the terrible things that happened in Rwanda, with the genocide in Rwanda, you had the eventual complete unleashing of many years of utter hatred against this other tribe, that had skirmishes with over 100 or 200 years even, and the hatred had boiled up, and it was really institutional, and they let loose, and literally the chopping up of people went on for weeks. You can actually hear it on the audios from people who were there at the time with cameras, you know, from reporters from abroad. You could actually hear it. It was terrible, and that's what happens when clever folk can utilize the hatred and stir it up and actually augment it, really thicken it, you might say, intensify, and then they use it for different purposes. Big coffee plantation growers were involved in this too, outside the country, because there's always other reasons for what you see in the news, always, and always other interests behind anything to do with skirmishes or wars. There's always economic interests lying deep below on behalf of those who understand resources and how to use them and who want them. Rwanda. Reporters were on the roads. It's like, it actually, I always think of these, whenever you see roads full of people, you think, remember, of refugees as one. Like, I always think of refugees in carts in Europe and so on, the beginning of, or even during World War One and then World War Two. But then you get the other refugees that really are promoted to come into countries now. These are like the massive invasion across Europe. That was all. That took billions of dollars to work all that out and to finance and even train them. Some of them coming in were telling you they'd all been trained in advance for purposes of taking down European countries. And we know some of the folk who were behind it, because they even put videos out themselves about it in some of these countries. Unashamedly, yeah. And then down the road, you use them, eh? To take down the nations. Just standard warfare technique. Migration has always been used for this kind of purpose. Migration was used in ancient times. You have biblical episodes of it, and pre-biblical too. Because not everything happens in the Bible, obviously. But you had different groups that would remove people of where they lived and transfer them to other nations in order to destabilize their power and dethrone them from over their own people, so that the people could be used by the conquering people coming in, you see. So there's different ways you can use migration, mass migration, by law. The Soviet era was awfully interesting, I always think, because the Soviet era used very, very old techniques, very, very old techniques. You get wisps of it through your lifetime. This is why it's important to try to always remember as much as you can per day as you're living through things. Yeah. Because real history is inside you. You live it. Forget the books that are written later that'll change it all. And so, you're living in history. And you must use your own perception. Don't be given it by someone else. You know? Anything that you're offered, investigate it completely to make up your own mind. But the Soviet system is just like the Norman system. Sent troops in, of course, to different countries like Latvia. You had Latvia, you've articles that coming out, you know, years later in Latvia after the so-called Soviet system collapsed, which it didn't really collapse as such, you know, not always presented. But yeah, you had Latvia and you had Ukraine, you had different countries where the Soviets had tremendous influence in the Soviet Pact countries, and they had troops into many of these countries, training them and so on, and it stayed them with full-time barracks, much the same as the US does today, across the Middle East and even Beirut at one time and so on. But the Soviets were given extra money if they would marry local women. The idea to breed themselves in to society, which would help dilute the cultural homogeneity of the people. It's much harder down the road, 20 years or 30 years down the road, for the entire people to stand up and throw you out. When by that time, at least one third of them are part Russian, you see. It's all through so many folks' families by that time. That's how it was done. And that was a deliberate policy. They paid the troops extra if they would settle in the areas by marrying girls in those areas where they were stationed. Very old system, a very old technique. And it smacks, as I say, the same kind of thing that happened with the Norman invasion into England or Britain, or England really. Even the Romans did try this too one time. And after the Romans really collapsed, or the same kind of thing, and went back home to Rome from England, they did leave a lot of people back in England at the time. And we have histories of them from monks. It was really interesting, of certain families that still stayed behind, and they were very old Roman families. But again, the Normans, when they came into Britain, they had Prima Nocta, which is first night, of course. And of course, the nobility would literally, if a maiden is going to get married in the local areas, with Saxon areas and so on, in England, they'd just take the right to have sex with them in the hope they'd get pregnant. So now you've got relatives within the local community that you'll groom to be in charge of the community. An old technique, really. Nothing new about it. I'm sure it might still go on in some parts of the world today. It wasn't just first night and the whole thing. The idea was to breed themselves into the people. And even their offspring would become future leaders over those peoples. In Ireland, you have an interesting situation where some of the Fitz, like Fitzsimmons and so on, often had noble parentage, but they were illegitimate, but they were still given a legal standing, you see, and so hence the prefix fits part to their names, Fitzgerald, etc. And so that still stood today. But again, this isn't getting off the topic. Really, what it is showing you is that great powers manage us all, and it doesn't come from little people in every generation just reinventing the wheel. These are sciences that are recorded and understood over many, many, many centuries, going way back to Plato and even before Plato's. Some of these philosophers in ancient Greece were awfully interesting because they were interested in what was happening around them, and they liked to put it down, especially in their schools. And the leisure class came to them, you know, and they were getting trained into this. And philosophy wasn't just there for passing the time, although the school came from the term, really, leisure, you know, and wealth and leisure. You had leisure, because the ordinary people hadn't time to learn anything except maybe a trade or something. But those who ruled the ruling classes, or maybe even castes for all that, in Greece is a huge area. It wasn't just a little. There's so many hundreds of islands, in fact, involved too. But some of them, again, were actually condemned by the state, some of these teachers, because they wanted to overthrow the system and bring in this new system. And Socrates, of course, was just get offered his poison because of that. There were definite charges laid against him. It's interesting, Enlightenment era, they always resurrect Socrates and his teachings. Interesting teachings, absolutely. And a good mind behind it, and maybe a better mind behind the translators, because you can fudge an awful lot of perhaps better thinking by translating it in a certain way. But anyway, you find that Socrates was also charged with literally trying to subvert the youth. It wasn't sexually. At least that wasn't promoted as such or part of the charge. It was to train the youth to overthrow the parents and the system, so to be revolutionaries. That's what it was about. And that, when it was brought out into the open, the parents and the nobility who just lost it, they said, what? Had no idea. And this all came out during the inquiries. It was so bad that many of the students had to flee for their lives because they were trained to be revolutionaries. Plato had to disappear for a while. And he did, quite a long time. And they had this interesting similarity to different groups that even, like the Essenes that came along too, in the Middle East as well. They had lots of things in common. Where you would get groups in, you would have an initial meeting groups, like an open day, put that way, every so often, where folk could come in and listen to the lower exoteric teachings. And they'd say, that's rather pleasant, etc. I wouldn't mind joining that. And then if one of the youngsters came in to join it, and probably paid by the parents who thought it would give them a good education, then if they had the right stuff, because they had levels and degrees, just like later groups had too, of induction, all the way up, as I say, to the Lord Alfred Milner group that has an inner party and an outer party. That's where the idea came from, George Orwell's 1984. The inner party and the outer party. And the circle of friends, etc., and the concern for foreign relations. So that's how very old ideas. And all elitist, you see, going way back to even Socrates, it's all to do with elitism. And through the various dialogues that they would have in their teachings, they'd always have a discourse, a kind of fantasy discourse with someone else as a teaching tool. And if I said to you, blah, 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 what would you reply or think? And then you try to guide them into what you the way you want them to think. But it's always to question what is. What is this and what is that? And not really to enlighten you as such, maybe partly, but then to take you off and reshape you and to now think about it this way, you know? Well, that's how people are recruited today for the most horrible things on humanity. Oh, what do you think all these little people? It's kind of like The Third Man, the movie. Awfully, one of the best movies ever made, The Third Man. It was so well directed and written and directed and filmed. Old black and white movie. And the location was fantastic during actual reoccupation of a country that was post-World War II, where you'd still had, and you'd still had the Russian and British and American and French quadrants, and these big cities were by the Allies, as they say, and all these displaced peoples. None of them wanted to be grabbed. If they had a background or come from a country that was now owned, run over, or ruled by the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union could take you back, just demand that you, even though you weren't in their country, you're in Vienna and so on. They could demand that you go back there, you see. Horrible things happened. But in the movie, the villain, Orson Welles, is up in, he's meeting his pal. His pal came over to see him, and his pal thought that Orson, you know, the Third Man, was dead because he had a fake burial. And then he found he was alive, and he came up to question him. And Orson Welles had been really been sought. The reason he pretended at death was he was sought by the police. and the Allied forces at the time, the military police, because one of his scams was getting penicillin and diluting it and then reselling it for big money. And it was so, and it went to children's hospitals and they were dying of meningitis and things. And of course, the antibiotic was no use. It was too diluted. All these scams did go on, by the way. Scams and medicine is, have always, we're up to the present time, as you all know, I'm sure. And so Orson Welles meets the guy on a carousel, a big, one of these big round wheels goes up around and so on. And they go up in it, and at the top, Welles talks to his friend that goes to see him. He said, look at all these people down there. Because his friend was saying, well, you know, you've been accused of this. Is this true? Your medicine is now killing children. And Orson Welles looks down and says, look at all those people down there. And he says, do you really think that this system thinks any more of those people, you know? He says, the state calls them the proletariat, you know. I call them the masses and so on. And the communists call them the masses and I call them the, you know. In other words, they're just little dots, he says. And how much is each dot really worth to you? And that's how a psychopath would describe humanity, the victims of whatever, they're just, you know, they're nothings. And that's how we're really ruled, folks. You have no idea of how many layers of psychopaths are churned out of academia and selected for their qualities as psychopaths, the particular traits, to do dastardly things over the general populations. They're generally arrogant, well-paid, trained in either psychology or behaviorism, often both, and persuasive techniques to teach so folk can be convinced to obey them, right down to even giving up your own life, you know. Are you really worth the money your government will spend on you? Why don't you just sign this little thing and decide, yeah, I've had enough. I've become a burden on, and you end up with eugenical euthanasia. It's here, folks. It's been here. I did the talks years ago when it was brought into Canada. I did the talks years ago when they'd introduced it into Holland, a big test case there. That's what they, a trial bed of it all. And yet, the public, just like getting drifting into war and drifting into everything, never figuring things out, because the media is so powerful, like the Rockefeller said, how many newspapers and magazines do we have to own to create the, basically the all newsworthy themes? We would be in charge of it all. That was back in the 1930s. And they did it all. Tonight, I'm going to put up a link to the Plandemic video. And this video is part of the Plandemic series. And so you can have a look at it. It's really, really good. It's well done. And it really is well done in the way it's, they show you clip by clip on one side of the screen the sequences of introducing a plague to the public, basically, under the actual exercise, the event 201 they had. You see them saying, here's the topics, here's what they say, and they have these actors doing these things. And then the right-hand side, you see the exact same things done in reality when COVID broke out, exact same sequences. Well done, well worth watching. No conspiracy here. I mean, you're seeing it. It's right from the horse's mouth, eh? Right down to, during the exercise, I've mentioned this before, before the movie was made, during the exercise, Event 201 said that we'll have to deal with fake information about it, and they'll start with just censoring this and censoring that, and then they'll end up arresting people if need be, and blah, blah. And that's, we're just following the script, folks. Yeah. And some other things, too, to do with other agencies that Bill Gates and his foundation run. The sound, you wouldn't know they're his, really, but they're all, it's a small group, really, with the Gavi and all the rest of them, the groups to do with vaccinations. And WHO, he funds a lot of that too. And maybe three quarters, it's been said, the funding goes to them. And so it sounds like all these official sources are saying the same thing. They must all, it has to be true. Until you realize they're all getting it from only one source. All of them, all these begins. But the news organizations just parroting, it's done again and well in the video. You see them all parroting the same lines, like verbatim, word for word, regardless of the name of the news company, because they're all on board with it. That's the beauty of standardized information coming from the same source. You can rule the world that way. Plato said something similar, by the way, so that also mentions it in the video, that the storyteller controls the country. Yeah. That's how it's done. Anyway, I'll put that one up. It's a must-see, folks. And who knows about if I'll be up for long or not. It's in BitChute right now. And BitChute 2, apparently, is now having an onslaught against it and succumbing to censorship, etc., in certain areas. So that's the way it goes. I said years ago, before I had a computer, and I was giving talks, because I never used a computer initially, and I only got it eventually simply because I was on full-time radio at the time. But up until then, no, I had stacks of books, I had good libraries, and had all the information I really needed to know what was going on. But I knew eventually, I knew that obviously that the whole idea with internet, from the very way they really launched it to the general population, both to children and adults, is awfully interesting. Because in the 1990s, they started dumping books out of libraries. They call it weeding. I've done talks on this whole process called weeding. You can look it up in your own areas, the weeding of books. And first they started with books that they didn't want the public to read. A tremendous censorship was happening. The folk hadn't a clue. And then they started dumping books, like generations of books that were built up, just dumping them. In the countryside, I saw stacks of them getting dumped in a local garbage dump. And that was happening all over the place. And most people haven't got a clue that even happened. And then towards maybe the middle of the 1990s, maybe 1996 or 7, but at the same time, 1995, where it was announced. Now remember, in 1995, most people were kind of sailing along. All you had at that time was the free trade deals and so on. You were losing all your factories abroad, and lots of folk were losing their homes because they ran out of places to work to pay their mortgages off. All signed and sealed and delivered by the politicians in every country. Every country was on board with this, the politicians were. But then in 1995, when all this was happening, I think it was the Toronto Sun. I can't remember the names. It was Grattan or something. I can't remember the guy's name, but he came out with an article, and he said that they'll tap our phones. I think it was tap our phones to please Uncle Sam. It was an agreement that had been made with Canada, just made with Canada and the States, to literally insert back doors into phones. It wasn't just like cell phones. It was all phones. And they said all communication devices. It was fax machines, everything. Had to have signatures so they could trace who they were, blah, blah, blah. And they couldn't sell any phone from then on or fax machine without these things inserted. Any communication device. Of course, the early cell phones were the same. And everybody was saying, well, what was going on here? Nothing was, you know, we weren't under terrorism at that time, except from the government. And then, of course, it was a few years later, not long, maybe 1998 or so, 97 or 98, that Alan Rock, who was Attorney General of Canada, passed, I guess he drafted it or something, but he passed the whole thing, it seemed by himself, to do with, it was an omnibus crime bill. And at that time, you had some reporters who could actually ask questions and dared to. And he said, what on earth is this? This isn't just a crime. This is an anti-terrorism scenario, whole omnibus thing. Will you be held indefinitely for different purposes without charges? All that. Oh, it's all in there. Before 9/11 happened, remember. So you're building up to this whole scenario. I mean, planned beforehand, folks. All of it. And then towards the end of that decade, too, they started bringing out initially trying to get police to wear combat gear, army gear, with army colours and so on. And it didn't go too well. That scenario is off. Here's a little spot.